Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Stone Cold Shots, the professional wrestling podcast where the shots are cold and the takes are hot. Every episode here, every 2 weeks, once a fortnight, we review, recap, rate a professional wrestling pay-per-view or PAPE or some other kind of professional wrestling happenings, happenstances.
Yeah. We report on all happenings here, wrestling related.
Hey, this is a current-ish kind of thing today. Mm-hmm. Although it won't be in 2 weeks when the episode actually comes out. But before we get to that, why don't you guys introduce yourselves? Tell the Stone Cold Shots universe what your name is. And if there is like a currently active, don't be fucking smart with this, all right? If there is a currently active, up-and-coming professional wrestler, somebody who's in the zeitgeist, that you could see main eventing, holding a heavyweight title when they are 58 fucking years old, who do you see in this current crop, this current generation of wrestlers?
Who is 58 currently?
No.
Okay.
So
when they're 58.
That's exactly what I meant by don't get smart with this. Like someone now, you know, I'll go first. I'm nobody's darling. I'm your heel host, Campbell Falconer.
Boo.
I think if somebody that I think who has like the career legacy, the athletic ability, the character longevity, someone that I think could main event, could hold a title when they are 58 years old. I think AJ Styles is somebody that I could see continuing to have a lucrative, like a great career, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to go, I'm Lauren. I'm a regular darling. And I think that Kenny Omega is so married to the craft of wrestling that he's going to work hard to stay in shape and stay active as best as he can. I see him being like a Chris Jericho sort of figure for as long as he can, trying to wrestle as long as he can, maybe trying to stay in a bit better shape because he's less into like booze and rock and like whatever.
Yeah.
So he'll have an easier time of staying in shape longer. So I think Kenny Omega will be doing that.
I feel like a year and a half ago, like the answer to this question would have been Chris Jericho. And now it's like, there's no way Chris Jericho's making it to 58 and
no
still
way.
Wrestling, right?
Like,
he could, but like, yeah, I feel like if you look at his, like, I don't know, like the way he moves, it is like, I guess, his figure, not to body shame Chris Jericho, but fucking I'm body shaming Chris Jericho. if you look at his figure from New Japan when he debuted there 2 years ago, and you watch that match, he's in way better shape than he is now. And I feel like it's kind of a rapid decline.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think he just gets comfortable. And it's because it's like an issue of priorities, right? Like he has other things that he's into. Like he has a podcast, he has his band. He has
heavily
like other
drinking.
Things that he likes. Yeah. You know, but you know, AJ Styles doesn't really, I don't know that he does anything outside of wrestling other than he has children. Mm-hmm. And like Kenny Omega is into video games, but like what, like I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like.
And if you feel like AJ Styles, AJ Styles is only like what, 15 years away?
He's like 48 or something, right?
That was kind of my thing. I was like cheating a little bit by picking like an older fella.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm not going to cheat at all. I'm the internet darling Josh Felix Pryor. And the face host of the podcast. And I'm going to say MJF. I'm going to say MJF is going to have real longevity. That kid is 25 years old. And I see him on the same trajectory as a Ric Flair. He's going to be cutting promos well. And if anything, it's going to age like a fine wine over time. And then it's going to get better and better. And then he's going to have these like stipulation matches the older he gets for like a retirement angle against an old Darby Allin. It's going to be main eventing WrestleMania with him. It's going to have the I'm sorry, I love you kind of moment.
But that's okay. So like
that's interesting.
I think the thing though is like, How old was Ric Flair the last time that he held a major championship?
He was in his 50s for sure. I think it was the last title he had was tag team champions with Batista, maybe?
Okay. But it's like, sure, I agree with you. Although I do, like, I think it's a dangerous pick going with someone so young and they're so far out. Anything could happen. MJF could, he could become the next Rock. He could completely leave WWE or leave wrestling and go to Hollywood with a, you know, a actor and a promo of that caliber.
He's a far way away
from the next Rock. It's a risky choice. It's a risky choice, but it's your choice to make, you know?
You know, he's a music theater guy. Maybe he's gonna be in...
What?
Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah.
No wonder he sang wanted to be so an opera well. Singer. Oh, I love that boy.
I feel like you guys played it safe.
Yeah, that's how you get to main event pay per views at 58 years of age, is playing it safe.
I'll also say the schedule is a lot lighter for the AEW guys. Like, if you look at like the guys that are going now, you know, AJ Styles and all these guys, they're working like 6-7 days a week. You know, whatever 300 and some odd
currently. Days.
Well, not currently.
Not current.
But when they're coming up, and they did years and years of that kind of work. MJF, you know, he's coming up to his prime, and he's working one night a week, if that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really good call. And, yeah, exactly. Some nights he just shows up and speaks, and that's all he has to do.
Sometimes once a month he's working.
Yeah. That's a good call.
So, as of recording, like, fucking... 5 days ago? No, I can't do math.
Does it matter?
Three days ago. Very recently, Keiji Muta, the great Muta, the great Muto, Keiji Muto.
He's gone by a lot of different names.
Yeah. Keiji Muto won the Pro Wrestling Noah GHC World Heavyweight Championship belt at 58 years of age, which is kind of amazing.
Which is crazy. You know, he's a triple crown champion in Japan, which is nuts.
Something only like three dudes have ever done.
Is that like getting an EGOT?
It's like Japanese wrestling EGOT for sure,
True EGOT would be winning those and then the WWE title as well, I think.
Okay. Yeah,
and then winning a Grammy. So we thought this would be a cool opportunity to kind of go back and look at, like, Muta's like a dude that I feel like I have like heard a lot about and is like a very well-traveled, like very storied career, but I actually haven't seen too much of his shit. So we kind of thought we'd take this opportunity to do a little like career retrospective episode and kind of look at like a handful of his matches throughout the years. Josh, you've been watching wrestling forever. What's your like coming into this? How do you feel about the great Muta?
Yeah, so all of my exposure to the great Muta was really through WCW, right? I think I first saw the great Muta in WCW when I was maybe 12. I want to say like it was super young, but it was one of the I think I want to say a Great American Bash or something like that. And I really don't remember the match I actually saw that he was in. But, you know, I remember thinking like, you know, at the time it's like, oh, this guy's so cool. And then I didn't hear from him again for like 2-3 years. And then, you know, he'd show up in another match or feud. And then, you know, at one point I think he joined the NWO. I'm not certain on that, but.
He was in NWO Japan for sure.
Yeah,
where he did like the Muta face paint, but with NWO written across his like nose.
But he's always been a presence in my wrestling life, right? Like he's always been around, and you know, so like I never followed him too closely in Japan, and kind of the name changes and the look changes and all that stuff. I kind of knew him as the great Muta who threw a bunch of kicks. Blue mist in people's faces, did moonsaults. Like that's all I really knew about the great Muta. And then actually for WrestleMania, I guess 2 years ago now, we went to the New Japan and ROH show at Madison Square Garden, me and Julian. And we actually got to see the great Muta live, which was pretty cool.
Oh, that's fucking cool. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it was a surprise entrant in the Battle Royal.
Yeah. You know who else was a surprise entrant? Enzo and Cass.
I think Tama Tonga's still pissed about that. They didn't smarten anybody up.
Look, Tama Tonga's still pissed about a lot of things, okay?
Like, Tama Tonga being pissed off is one of my favorite things going on in wrestling right now.
I put forth a theory that I think if Bullet Club was Fast and Furious, that Kenny Omega would be The Rock and Tama Tonga would be Tyrese. if you know, real heads know. Lauren, like, are you familiar with Muta at all? Is this, like, something that through osmosis of watching wrestling you're, like, familiar with?
Absolutely not. I've never heard of him.
Okay. So I'm trying to think of, like, he's, like, just kind of like a legacy, like, Japanese wrestler. I know, like, a lot of the times in when I watch New Japan, like, I think he trains Sanada, and Sanada's, like, finishing moves as he does the moonsault, and a lot of the time they'll, like, refer to Sonata's finisher is like the Muta moonsault. And like, yeah, again, kind of knowing like he was one of this crop of like Japanese guys that WCW brought over. Like we've watched like WCW stuff in the past where they had Ultimo Dragon or they had Gato or like, you know, we've seen like Hayabusa. So like being tangentially familiar with this guy, so I kind of went through, I just like did a quick Google of like, what are the best like Muta matches? And I didn't necessarily pick the ones that are like deemed the best, cause I kind of wanted to go for something that was like a little bit of WCW, a little bit of New Japan, a little bit of Noah, a little bit of All Japan. Like this is a guy who really wrestled everywhere and kind of did everything. So I tried to grab,
I think he did a like pretty good spread, like as far as like,
yeah,
you know, I think maybe like there's like one or two kind of eras missing in there, but I think for the most part, you got it mostly nailed. And for, like for a guy who's
for been a dude who's been wrestling since like fucking 1984,
he's almost as old as I am. Like he debuted in 1984, and I was born in 1982. So it's like he's been wrestling like almost as long as I've been alive, right?
Yeah. I think the biggest notable absence from what we're about to watch is his match in, I'm pretty sure it was All Japan against Hase, where he bled so much that like people had created the Muta scale of bleeding in a match. And I just left that out because I didn't fucking feel like watching that. Like,
let's keep it light.
I didn't.
Let's keep it light.
Yeah. I didn't want to get like super fucking bummed out.
About someone almost dying in the rain. Yeah.
No, I'll say you definitely, you had a good selection here. As I was watching the matches, I felt like you got a good kind of mix.
Thank you. Our listeners, you know, you can fucking hop on the Twitter, pull the old Tama Tonga, tell me if I fucked up.
Yeah. Feel free to
tell me if we should have watched that Nagata match that was so highly recommended on Reddit. I don't know. Getting into it, the first match that we did, coming from the Great American Bash 1989, Josh, maybe this is the one that you watched.
Although, I think this was a little,
you would have been 7 and not 12.
I think, well, because I started watching WWF around this time. I think it was like 98, maybe like, 88, 87 around that time. I don't think I was on the WCW train until my dad started getting a legal cable.
Okay.
We had the black box, yeah. So maybe like early 90s I started WCW.
So we got the Great Muta versus Sting at the Great American Bash 1989. For the NWA Television Championship, which Sting comes into the match having.
Yeah. So Muta comes out first. He comes out accompanied by Gary Hart, who was his manager. I don't really know anything about Gary Hart, and he didn't really do anything, so I don't really have any characterization to assign to him based on this match. But
his father ran the Hart Dungeon in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
He didn't seem like a Hart.
I don't think he's a real Hart, Campbell.
Oh, okay. His father was Jimmy Hart, the Mouth of the South.
Oh, there you go. Jimmy Hart's old enough, man. That guy's like 90.
Yeah. So Muta's entrance is like, we got the gong. They hired John Carpenter to write some synth music from Big Trouble in Little China for his, like...
And I think this was, like, around the time. So, like, Gary Hart obviously being a heel manager. I think it was one of those gimmicks where it was like they're bringing... He's bringing in a gun for hire, like a paid hand to come take out Sting and take the TV championship away from him.
So I was doing a little bit of... like kind of Googling to get some context on some of these matches.
Yeah.
And this was, cause Gary Hart had initially been the manager for the Great Kabuki, okay. In the '80s, who was like a Japanese wrestler and Gary Hart and the Great Kabuki actually like together invented and pioneered the Green Mist. Which when Muta was coming over to America, they were like, okay, we're going to pair you up. And he was billed as the son of the Great Kabuki. So there was a little bit of lineage with Hart there managing Muta and giving him the Green Mist, not to jump too far ahead.
It's okay. He does it in his entrance.
Oh, yeah, he does.
Well, I guess that's Gary Hart's greatest legacy to the wrestling business is inventing or co-inventing the Green Mist, right?
Honestly, that's the coolest cool. fucking legacy. Like yeah. that is
that's a pretty cool legacy.
Amazing.
Okay, Sting comes out. He's so over. Like the crowd is losing their minds just for his entrance. Sting is wearing a silver jacket with very long, fine tassels on the arms. Red tassels coming down, and there's a really cool red scorpion on the back. This era is a great time for Sting fashion. Like he looks sick.
How he looks like a star. Like, and you could, like, he was so big.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's all I had on Sting and his look. He looked great.
Do you think that Ryan Gosling in Drive was inspired by Sting?
Oh, had to
definitely.
Be.
Like, the fashion designer was like, it's going to be a cool scorpion on the back of the jacket. Like, because that wasn't Ryan Gosling's decision. It was like the fashion designer for that movie was like, I grew up watching wrestling and I thought Sting in his shiny bomber jackets with a fucking scorpion on the back was the hottest look.
Yeah. Do you think the original like concept art for Drive had Ryan Gosling in a tasseled jacket as well? Like just the scorpion. This is, so it's like the
his
more
face painted.
Yeah. The more that we go back and watch like this, like late 80s, early 90s WCW stuff, like we've done a couple things on the pod. Laura and I have been still sort of like going through that list of Dave Meltzer, like 4.5 and higher rated star matches. And like the more that I see this version of Sting, the more I'm like, this dude is way cooler than the Crow Sting.
Mm-hmm.
He's so much more fun to watch and he's so much more interesting. And I understand, like, why they did it, but, like, I prefer this Sting to the Crow.
We were talking about it, and I, like, Josh, we didn't experience it, so I'm just projecting, but to me it makes a lot of sense. Like, I think they probably chose a pretty good time to switch his look over, because, like, they were competing with WWF at the time, which had, like, The Undertaker and really cool, like, cool, dark... zany over-the-top characters, and like I feel like as the crowd started to get more smarky, such a pure all-American like gold and red and white
meat baby face as they call him.
Yeah. I feel like that wouldn't resonate as much, so I feel like having him become a more darker version of himself and be like a Punisher type character.
It was so cool the time that they did it. Like they did it like I guess around the time the NWO was formed. The story behind it was exactly that, right? Like Sting was always like the face of WCW, that like kind of like, you know, face of the company, white meat baby face kind of guy. And then like the story was like the company and the fans all kind of like turned their back on Sting. And so he disappeared, and this is commitment. He disappeared for like a year or something like that. He disappeared for a long time while like NWO ran crazy. And then he just randomly started to appear, and like, you know, this is close to the Crow coming out. So it was so cool at the time. You see him in the rafters, and he's just pointing a baseball bat, didn't say a word. there was like nothing, and they really committed to it. And I think it wasn't until like 6 or 8 months after that that he actually like debuted in the match against Hogan. And then they fucked it all up from there. But the build to the actual Sting, the new look and everything. But I'm with you. This is like Hulk Hogan, real American level babyface.
It's like seeing Sting in AEW, like, kind of tarnishes, like, the cool mystery of the Crow Sting.
Because he still talks like a normal...
Oh my god, him using his normal voice is so distracting. Oh.
It's the thing is, he cuts... If he was in, like, this Sting makeup, cutting the promos that he's currently cutting in AEW, I would be fine with it.
Totally.
Because he cuts promos like a normal all-American dude in a tasseled jacket.
He's just like... You know what? We don't like you. And it's like, that's not how the Crow talks. He has to talk like Ichabod, like Sammy Callahan, going like
Bane. Like Darby Allin. I think you're rad. Tony Schiavone, my homeboy. How you doing, bro? And he's got his arm around him. And it's like, what the fuck is it? Like, what are we doing? Like, you have the eerie, snowy, you know, gothic music entrance. And then you come out and you're like, you're throwing a fucking cowabungas.
Yeah. It's so true.
Anyway, like this match though. So this like fucking kicks off. It's the battle of the face paint.
Muda's got his face painted red.
Yep.
Also Muda, like, just, I don't know, I don't want to get beyond the entrances, but like
No, let's get into it. Fucking give her.
Let's go.
No, I mean, part of the entrances is that there's like two rings for some reason.
I think they were going to do a war games later.
Yeah. But Muda is waiting in one ring, and as Sting is entering, and Muda just gets up on the top turnbuckle and sprays his green mist up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
It's sick. It's like a sick, like, menacing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He did it like Triple H, just straight up.
Yeah. And then Muda like won't get into the proper ring. So Sting just, like, does a fucking crossbody over the two top ropes.
Which is crazy. That was such an agile
and,
fucking
shit
sick
kicks
move.
Off. And this match is great. It's, like,
it's so good.
Fast-paced. Sting is so fucking over. Muda, for, like, a dude his size, like, can fucking fly. You know?
Crazy. Crazy. And it looked great.
Yeah, I love the, like, pacing of this match. I was impressed by it. Because whenever I'm not as familiar with older wrestling, like, from the, given this is the late 80s, but I never assume it will be wrestling that I'm used to seeing now. Like, extremely fast-paced, high impact. And this shit starts high impact and high pace, and it just stays there the whole time. It is so sick.
Yeah, like, and on... I honestly, like, it was kind of like watching this match was like the great Muda's plucked from the future and dropped in a ring with, you know, 80s wrestling Sting. And, like, Sting kind of at the top of his game for 80s wrestling. Muda, like, you know, seemingly the top of his game, doing shit that I'm assuming nobody in WCW or nobody in the wrestling world in North America had really seen at the time. And, they put on a banger. This was a great match.
It's Muda hits specifically in this match, and it's kind of a signature move of his that he does in all of these matches. But like seeing him in this do that, like he does like a handspring back elbow into the corner, and that's a move that like the first time that I saw anyone do that move was probably like Ember Moon in NXT, and even like when I saw her do it, I was like, wow, that's such an innovative move. That's crazy. I wonder if she invented that. And to see a fucking dude who probably outweighs Ember Moon by like 100 pounds hit a fucking handspring back elbow in 1989 is like, what? So good.
And it looks so crisp, and it looks so like he's so good at everything he does. And like, just like everything in through the matches, kicks are like on point.
Sorry, I think you mean his karate kicks are on point.
Oh my god, there's a line in the match. You remember when he came off the top and he hit Sting with an overhand chop? And he's like, oh, he just hit Sting with a karate chop. Oh, my mistake, that was a judo chop.
Yep. We got some real
That's some late JR 80s going on. Late 80s JR commentary.
Yeah.
Hasn't changed much in the last, what, 22 years?
How long ago was it that JR called somebody Oriental?
like literally last year.
Yeah. He's like, still thinking back to Muda. He's like, oh, well, I don't understand it. You know, Muda loved it when I called him the Pearl of the Orient.
No, remember Muda had Sting in a sleeper. He's like, oh, he's got him in an Oriental sleeper.
Yeah. Oh,
God. It's like, come on.
I did not catch any of that.
So here's the thing. Is like, I really like this match. And JR notwithstanding, like, my least favorite part, my biggest issue with this match is, like, how much commentary is talking up how, like, Sting's got to look out for Gary Hart. Sting's got to, like, watch out for interference from Gary Hart. And it seemed like that's why Sting also had, like, a second. Like, Sting had a dude coming down with him.
Hot stuff, and, Eddie Gilbert.
There you go. I was just about to say that. I know the guy's name.
Okay. Hot, that sounds like some rando from the audience, essentially.
Yeah. Hot guy... No. Hot guy Tommy Jordan. And it, like, that was a thing that, like, never resolved and felt like when you have, like, exactly like you were saying, Josh, you had, like, Sting at kind of, like, the height of his, like, Surfer Sting gimmick, and you have Muda just, like, pulling this, like, cool, mysterious, like, Eastern, and it's a thing where it's, like, it's where do you draw the line between the trope and of being cool and being, like, super racist, you know, like,
but yeah, like and, honestly, and how, like, good those two I say this all the time, but it, like, mm-hmm. like the 80s and the 90s, there
for sure,
there was,
for sure,
there wasn't that stigma and stuff, and it's like, of course, like, listening back to, like, any, like, Attitude Era stuff now and, like, mm-hmm. commentary from the 80s, of course, it's going to be cringe worthy, and you're like, oh, fuck, like, how is this ever, like, okay, but, you know, I get the pass.
It's like you have the like, white meat babyface All-American against, like, this mysterious dude, and the caliber of workers that those two are is, like, why do you need to have this whole bullshit with the managers that never really comes into it anyway?
I mean, there is no bullshit with the managers, because mm-hmm. neither Sting second nor Muda second get involved at all. Like, no one does anything. So, I don't know. They were just there for emotional support. Commentary shouldn't have been talking them up.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like commentary kind of, like, undersold this match a little bit, which is, like, something that we're going to get into again and again with these matches that we picked. The most that happens is, like, Muda goes for a red mist. Mm-hmm. He misses and hits the ref. Mm-hmm. And Gary Hart rolls in, like, a fresh ref so that Muda can try and, like, get a quick pin or something.
Well, yeah. It and the thing is, like, Muda wasn't even trying. Like, it was a clean pin, and mm-hmm. like, he had it for over 3 seconds, but the ref wasn't there. And by the time he got the fresh ref in, Sting was had recovered enough. And then Sting just does, like, a really quick little, like, suplex or something and pins Muda. And then there's some controversy because, like, mm-hmm. in the replay, you can tell that Muda lifts his shoulder at the last second, and they're trying to, I feel like they were trying to say, like, oh, but when Muda lifts his shoulder, Sting's shoulders are down, so maybe Sting was pinned. And I was like, I feel like no one was pinned. I feel like it was just a fuck up, like,
which is, like, kind of classic, like, dusty finish kind of shit.
Yeah,
like,
that's a totally dusty finish, right?
I was here for it. I thought it was, like, an interesting finish. I was like, I definitely would watch these two wrestle again. Yeah.
I didn't mind it. I also really love that Muda and Hart just, like, took the belt and they were like, peace!
Yeah.
And they just left. And Sting was just like, what the fuck?
This is great. Honestly. Wow. And, you know, like, this match was around 10 minutes long. I know we talked about the match longer than the match actually fucking lasted. But this is perfect. Like, I don't know. This is a great debut. If this was the debut for Muda, it was a great debut for Muda.
I don't think it was the debut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everything looked great. I think the only kind of takeaway, I agree with Campbell, where it's like they're talking up the managers and they had no real involvement in the match. So,
mm-hmm.
Especially Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert. I didn't see him once during the match. There was a cut to a camera of him running around or something, but he didn't actually do anything.
No.
Anyway, it's got 3.5 bald heads. I thought this was...
3.5 bald heads. All right.
That's more than serviceable. That's good.
This is great. I thought it was a really good match. And especially, like, for the time and everything, this is great.
So our next match, we're jumping forward 2 years to New Japan Professional Wrestling's G1 Climax 1991. We've got Big Van Vader against Keiji Muto.
What a fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It was so amazing watching Vader come out. I like, talk about pomp and circumstance, but like, it was so sick.
Vader's old entrance was the best. Like, so like, you know that like big fucking crazy helmet he had?
Mm-hmm. It's like a breastplate helmet.
Yeah. So he used to blow smoke out of that, but then he used to set it in the middle of the ring. And then it like blew smoke everywhere. It was like, and it used to be like on command that he'd do that. Crazy.
I really liked him like hoisting it onto his shoulder and walking out into the crowd and being like, all the New Japan young boys are like, no, Vader-san, like we need to go to the ring. Like fucking, so this is.
And there's this like ripping guitar solo.
And this is cool because we have like, Muto, who's like ditched the great Muta gimmick, and he's coming out as like now it's his turn to be the white meat babyface company guy against the foreign heel back in Japan, which is really cool. I was looking up, I was doing a little bit of research on the background for this match. So first of all, filmed by a fan in the audience, the video that we watched on YouTube is like a bootleg fan cam that is the only known recording of this match.
They did such a good job.
Yeah.
They zoom in and shit.
Yeah. So that's like,
oh my God.
Wow.
Fucking cool as hell. This was also,
that's why it cuts in and out a couple of times, right? Oh my God, that's crazy.
And so I guess this event at this point for New Japan, like it wasn't filmed, it wasn't broadcast, it wasn't televised or whatever. Like this was, they were only doing fucking like live wrestling events.
Muto like to add to it, like again, like he's like this baby face entrance wearing like a stand, he reminds me a lot of Ibushi a little bit, like just kind of like the way he's carrying himself, his build a little bit, like he's very top heavy. He's like super in shape, but he's wearing like the shorts. He's got the hair. He's got like the baby face good looks. Like Misawa. What?
It very. I was thinking Misawa as well. Yeah. That's a great call. Yeah.
Okay,
it's also, I believe that this was the block final, and both Vader and Muto were undefeated going into this match. So it was whoever won this was going on to the G1 Climax finals.
Gotcha.
So high stakes, immovable force meets unstoppable object, fan cam.
It's almost the same.
Go.
It's close enough. This match was this match was great. This was such a good match from everything. Like, so they're stiff as hell with each other. Vader's throwing
so stiff,
fucking brutal,
fucking bombs. Like he's hitting him with what looks like potatoes, and then you know Muda's hitting him with fucking stiff ass kicks. But like, you know what I really liked during this match? You could tell Vader was also really taking care of him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like everything.
I'm not educated enough. For me, I was just like, he's being horrible to him. Somebody save him.
He's hitting him with these big fucking potatoes to the face, right? But then like when it comes to like making sure Muta doesn't land incorrect, Vader is doing everything in his power to like catch him right. He's landing things that they look good, like he's throwing them, and I'm sure they fucking hurt. But they're not like knocking him out, right? Like so it's like,
yeah.
They were throwing good, everything in this, and like the crowd was electric during this match as well.
Oh my God, the crowd cannot handle, like they are freaking out. I think this is the one where there's somebody in the crowd really close to this cameraman. So maybe it is the cameraman just screaming himself hoarse.
Yeah.
Like there's a fan who you can hear way clearer than all the other fans just based on his proximity to the actual filming camera. And you can hear his voice get hoarse over the course of this match.
Yeah.
Losing his mind trying to cheer on Muto. Like, oh my God, it's so good. Oh, the crowd.
And it's, The narrative of the match as well, I think, is really great, where it, like, you start out with Vader just, like, fucking heavy hitting, throwing these punches.
Loving him.
Muto's got to take a little breather outside of the ring. And then Muto gets back in, and he comes in, and he's so quick.
Yeah.
And he hits a couple of strikes to the point where he just punches Vader out of the ring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, okay, cool. Now we've set the stakes here, right? And then it's fun to watch Muto as, like, this is a dude who, throughout his legacy, I've always thought of, like, a bigger guy in terms of, like physically a larger guy in terms of your traditional Japanese professional wrestler, right? He's definitely not a Kenta. He's definitely bigger than a Misawa.
Mm-hmm.
So to see him in this being the smaller guy to Vader and getting to do all of this, like, high-flying shit, like, this match that he wrestles is closer to, like, a Tanahashi match than what I would have expected from this dude who I think of as kind of like a bigger guy.
Yeah.
And it's really, really fun to watch. It's like, they fight out onto the outside. They're fucking throwing each other into barricades, tearing up, like, Vader's getting pissed, tearing up the mats, you know, it's great. It's like perfect heel face David Goliath storytelling.
And it's cool because, like, you can see Vader learn throughout the match. Like, the storytelling of the match was really cool because, like, Muto gets his, like, I don't remember. It's like a hamstring back elbow.
His, like, handspring back elbow that he does on the outside into the fucking barricade.
So yeah. He does it a couple times throughout this match. And he does it enough that Vader learns. And then later when he does it, Vader catches him and then suplexes him. Because he has learned how that move goes. And he's ready to fucking make him pay for doing it too much.
He, like, Vader, like, catches him in a Nelson. And then transitions that into one of the roughest looking uranagis I've ever seen.
Oh, I thought it was a suplex. I'm sorry.
It's like a modified suplex, but it's, like, specifically that, like, picking him up one arm and just throwing him down right on his fucking neck.
It was nasty.
Yeah, looked brutal.
And, like, the suplexes and, like, again, like, the back and forth and, like, really not knowing which way the match is going to go. Like, honestly, I was watching it. I had no idea who was going to win. I was completely engaged. They had a lot of, like, false finishes and, like, near falls. And, you know, like, it was so good. And, like, you could plop this match into a fucking Tokyo Dome show now. And that would be, like, it would be one of the best fucking matches on the card.
Yeah. No, easy. It was so good. And I actually liked it better than a lot of current wrestling that follows the same kind of, like, the really, like, the strong style heavy hitters, I find, are usually, like, fucking 35 minutes long. And this one felt shorter, and it was, like, way better paced, I think, than current stuff, which relies on a lot of, like, breathing and pacing and, like, building the intensity. This one was just high intensity the whole time, and it was a bit shorter, and I liked it.
It's also, like, Josh, to your point, when you were talking about the suplexes, is, like, one of the biggest spots in this match is Muto hitting a belly-to-back suplex on Vader.
Yes.
Right? And it's, which was fucking, like, I popped for that. Like, just seeing this dude who's gone through this match pick up such a giant man and hoist him over his shoulder and suplex him. And it's like, I can't, for like, however great, however many 6-7 fucking stars a match gets, like, if you can't make me feel that level of emotion with a move as simple as a suplex, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying it's, like, that, like, Omega Okada is, like, a bad match or whatever, or necessarily a worse match than this. Like, they're great, but there's something to be said about the simplicity of this.
It's just great. Like, you nailed it. It's great storytelling, great emotional, like investment into a match. You're invested in both people because both people are telling a story and they're killing it. They're both fucking killing it. Like, that's wrestling. Like, this is wrestling 101. It doesn't matter what era you watch it from. It doesn't matter if anybody's doing a reverse run off the top rope or like a belly to back suplex. It's like, how invested are you and how big of a moment was that in the match?
Yeah,
100%. This is great.
And you get, so, like, the finish of the match is incredible too, because you can really tell, like, Muto's throwing the kitchen sink, right? He's hitting the elbows, he's hitting the drop kicks, he's doing the moonsaults, and he's going for these pins, and Vader's kicking out, and Vader is hitting some fucking huge moves on Muto as well. And Muto's kicking out. And real quick side note, one of the things that I really, really like about this is, like, every time that Vader goes for a pin, like, when Muto kicks out, Vader just, like, stays sitting on top of him. He doesn't do that thing where, like, you know how, like, normally wrestlers, like, kick out and the guy who's doing the pin, like, the force of the kick out is so strong that they get blown backwards?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or they'll just sit up. Like, they'll just let it happen and they'll use that time to look at the ref and be like, really?
Yeah, and it's cool to see a dude just, like, sit on top of a guy. So, Muto goes for, like, a crossbody off the top rope. Vader catches him and tries to turn it into a slam. And Muto rolls him up. And it's like that, like, the smarts out, you know, he outwits the strength of Vader. Muto wins, and the crowd is so fucking ecstatic that they throw their seat cushions into the ring.
So sick. Like, just a crowd going apeshit. Like, just
such a genuine display of emotion.
Glee.
So good.
And then Vader gives him the handshake and raises the hand and gives him the rub.
Yeah, I love this too, because he did it in such a way that, like, didn't break his character. He's, like, so intense about it. He just, like, walks up, really stiff handshake, raises his arm, drops his arm, and gets the fuck out
of the
ring.
Like, throws his arm down. He, like, throws his arm. He's like, ah.
Yeah, he's just like, you fucking won.
Yeah.
Bye. Like,
How many bald heads did this get?
Okay, I want to ask you two, how many bald heads do you think this is going to get?
I'm going to say 4.25.
I'm saying 4.
It's 4.25. This gets 4.25. I loved the shit out of this match. And, like, you can pop this again in any fucking pay-per-view, any generation. This is a great match because great storytelling always wins in a match.
Yeah, also, and, like, you don't even need, like, a video package going in. Like, there is no lead-up to this match needed. All of the storytelling is contained within this match.
There was no My Way by Limp Bizkit before it. There was nothing before. It was just, again, and then two people that, and I appreciate things like taking care of each other in a match, but, like, really bringing it and really hitting each other and then investing me in a match. This whole story was, chef's kiss. I loved it.
Next up, also from New Japan Pro Wrestling, jumping forward 5 years to 1996, we have the Great Muta, once again doing the Great Muta gimmick, against
Evil gimmick.
Jushin Liger.
This is like scary Muta. Like, you can tell, like, he's fully embraced the heel kind of persona. He's like trying to spook people at ringside, you know? He looks...
Oh my god, that's the best.
He's
full-on, like, twirly villain, but, like, more from, like, a... Like, I want to say he's, like, more of a demon, scary, animalistic villain, where he's, like, screaming at women in the audience, and the women are terrified, and they're just screaming, and he's, like, looking under the ring for nothing. Like, he's just being sinister and fucking shit up. Like, at one point, he gets out of the ring and, like, rips up a mat on the ground, even though he doesn't seem to plan anything with it. He's just fucking shit up. But at the same time, while he's doing this very angry shit, he's also so sinister because he's, like, very plodding and methodical and nonchalant about everything. Like, he's just stalking around the ring, taking his time getting back in. He seems to, like, not give a fuck about the ref counting ever. Like, he never cares that the ref is counting. He, at one point, during a 20 count to get back in the ring, he just grabs a camera and starts, like, mugging, making villain faces and sticking his tongue out at the camera instead of getting back in the ring.
Yeah.
It's sick. No. He's, like, reveling in being a villain.
And he's, like, he's got the gold face paint and he comes out and just, like, as part of his entrance, like, almost Triple H style, like, just shoots the green mist.
Yeah.
Like, while he's just hanging out in the corner of the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get like, Liger being, like, the primo, like, super junior baby face, you know.
He's all silver. He's in his
pay-per-view whites.
His pay-per-view silver chrome.
It's crazy. Liger has been the exact same for so many years. Like, he's been, like, the same fucking character, the same fucking match. Like, I love Liger. I think Liger's great. He can do this forever. I feel like even though he's retired now, I'm going to change my answer from earlier, and I'm going to say Liger is going to be the guy that's going to be wrestling until he's 58. But
I feel like he was 58 and still wrestling. I feel like he retired at like 62.
He was in his 50s for sure. I think he's a little younger than Muta, though.
Okay.
But that's the joy about Liger. He's such a good baby face, right? Like, Liger mm-hmm. is the perfect foil to this. And, like, Muta, like, as a heel in this match, yeah, sure, he's like, animalistic and like that over the top heel, but I love that. I think that type of heel is so good because it's almost campy, right? Like, it's almost that campy heel that's so ridiculously over, like I'm such a bad guy and I'm doing all these really bad things that it's just enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, it's like Pee Wee Herman being a heel when he's like walking down the dark alley and he just goes like, and the kids run away screaming.
There's watching. So this is the only match of the five that we're talking about that I had seen before. And I put this on here because this is like a personal favorite. I love this match. This is one of the coolest things that I think I've ever seen in wrestling. But watching this specifically in the context of like having just watched the Sting match and then watching the Vader match, it really feels like we're now hitting Muta's stride as like a fully realized character.
Yeah.
And this is like, he's taking everything that was like campy and gimmicky and stupid in WCW and filtering that through like Vader as like a savage, big hoss heel. And he's marrying those two things here. And I don't know if that's like actually the narrative of the character, if that's actually sort of how it happened, but just again, specifically in the context of watching those two matches and then this, it's like, oh, you can really see pieces of this guy's career kind of coalescing into this character and this portrayal in this match.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like he really brought it all together. And like, it's like where he wanted to be with the Sting match kind of coming in and still mm-hmm. like a relative, like kind of, it's like what, like he started in 84, that was 89. And yeah. then like kind of like transitioning over to that baby face. I feel like this is a really refined character.
Yeah, I also feel like if he had done this character against Sting, it would have seemed more racist. But
there's even something about like the body language, though, is just like the way that like he like kind of jitters and creeps. Like there's a couple yeah. elbows that he throws. There's like he does a couple of like elbow drops that are almost, it's almost like the people's elbow where the Rock kind of mm-hmm. comes in and like kicks out his leg. Yeah. But done, it's like an evil, twisted, like bizarro version of the people's elbow. That like is like the heel version of doing that.
Yeah, jittery is a really great way of putting it. Even like there were a couple parts where he was just running in to do like a elbow strike or something, and the way that he did it was he would lead into it regular pace and then jerk into the motion and then recoil at a regular pace. So it seems like you're watching it at a fucked frame rate almost, like or mm. like he's moving in a really inhumane way, like yeah. not consistently.
And I was reminded, it's cool. I was reminded of Tajiri too. Like if you watch mm-hmm. Tajiri's career, you can tell he drew so much from the great Muta just watching this match alone. Like his kind of yeah. like skulking walk, the way he, like his like mannerisms and stuff like that. It's like it's really cool to see because like Tajiri was one of my favorite wrestlers for a long time, like through ECW and WWE. Mm-hmm. But like seeing this, I'm like, oh yeah, that's 100% Tajiri. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
that's cool.
Yeah.
So for me, it cool kind of reminded me of Pentagon, but it's because I'm not as familiar with Tajiri. But yeah. for me, Pentagon seems like an evolution of this, where he has like a slinky walk as well, his uh-huh. like slinky villainous walk,
and he's like spooky to the audience and stuff.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Okay, so the first half of this match, we've talked about the character. It's a pretty standard kind of exchange of like your, it's almost a role reversal of the last match of this David versus Goliath with Liger being like the
Liger's faster.
He's faster. Muta's still fucking fast as hell though. Some of those kicks that he's throwing Ooh. Like are insane. But this match, so So Muta, like, I feel like the turning point, the tipping point in this match is when Muta gets Liger on the outside and pile drives him through a table in the audience.
And then he gets a cord out and starts choking him.
Mm-hmm.
That's the turning point.
He creates a karat and he just starts fucking choking him out. And then, like, it all starts, like, that's where, like, the ramp up of the entire match happens, right?
Yeah. This is where it gets to the screaming point. And Muta also, like, he tries to, this is a really cool thing for me because it was an instance of something not going as planned and the wrestler improvising in a beautiful way. So Muta tries to, like, stand or, like, lean the already dented table from that pile driver up against the ring, clearly to throw Liger onto it, and the table won't stand. Like, it won't lean because it's been crushed in such a way that won't allow it to do so. He picks up the table and just smashes it over Liger's head. A beautiful way of just being like, fuck, whatever.
Yeah.
Duh, I'm a heel. Like,
just his mannerisms through that whole thing where, like, he tries to stand it up, it falls over, he looks annoyed, he tries to stand it up again, he looks, like, even more annoyed. And then he just grabs the table. He's like, fuck this. And he just throws the table at Liger. It was such a good improv. Like, it was such a good,
exactly.
Like, yeah. Oh, it made me so happy.
It saves the moment. Like, it totally deflates what would have been a botch.
Yeah.
And then Liger starts to get a little bit of a babyface comeback. He's hitting some pile drivers. He's hitting some drop kicks. Muta rolls out and, like, sort of, like, hides under the ring, slinks away.
Yes, slithers under the ring.
And then Liger goes to chase him under the ring, and they fucking film
under the ring.
Under the ring, which is something that I've never seen before.
There's way less shit under there than I thought.
Yeah.
It's empty space.
It's so funny. Every time in WWE that somebody, like, flips up the apron too far to get a chair, you can always see there's, like, a fucking 40-pack of Gatorade under there. And I saw Liger's, like, chasing him. I'm like, hey, bro, where's the Gatorade? What the fuck?
Yeah, I always think you do. I was like, there's way less under there than I imagine. Like, in a WWE ring, I imagine they have, like, 25 ladders.
Tight.
55 chairs.
Titus O'Neil.
Yeah.
Hornswoggle. And then, so they get back into the ring, and Muta starts beating down Liger and tears open his mask.
And apparently releasing the Jushin Thunder Liger, or just Jushin Liger persona.
War Liger.
Kishin Liger. Kishin Liger.
This is, like, one of the greatest, like, top five moments in professional wrestling history, I think, is, like, when he stands up and you see, it's they did it so perfectly where it's, like, the two halves of the mask perfectly hanging around his face with the, like, demon face paint underneath.
That is somehow perfectly preserved. He's been wearing it for a full match under a mask, and it's perfect.
This match went, like, from, like, a 30 to, like, 100. Like, I've never experienced such a ramp up in a match where I was like, this fucking rules. Like, I had never seen this match before. I was like, this is so fucking cool.
Yeah. Kishin stands up. Muto has, like, a second to register that he has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And then he mists him. He immediately mists Muto.
So, yeah, Kishin Liger hits the red mist on Muto.
And then he just unleashes so much brutal offense, like, with chairs, with tables, with a fucking stake.
The fucking chair off the top rope to the outside is crazy.
He just does, like, about 5 minutes of pure ruthless aggression offense.
Yeah.
And this is where the crowd switches. The crowd is watching this kind of silently, just like, what the fuck? Our guy has changed. And then, so after this onslaught of violence, and the crowd is so shook, Liger takes it even further, and he's got, like, a chair leaned up on the turnbuckle.
He's got a table leaned up in the corner.
A table leaned up in the corner. And he comes at fucking Muto with a stake, like a Buffy the Vampire-ass wooden stake, and he's trying to stab him in the chest, and Muto jumps out of the way, and he ends up staking the table with this spike, and it's the most intense shit. Like, he staked the table. He went full force with that.
This is 1996. Like, this is 96 before any of this shit, like an ECW or any of this shit was really happening. I can't imagine what it was like to watch. I would be fucking shitting my pants if I was watching this live.
Like, that's... The superhero literally transforms into an evil demon that is worse than the evil demon he's fighting. And the Shoot crowd tries to murder him in the middle of the match.
So and good. Obviously the crowd switches and starts cheering for Muto because he didn't get stabbed right there.
Yeah.
And then Muto, like, he missed Sliger and then he wins. Like, he missed Sliger and then he does, like, a...
I think he hits a moonsault.
Yeah.
Yeah, he hits a moonsault, but it was such a win. It was such a good moment. Like, when, like, so, like, Liger was, like, he was, like, clearly going to win. Like, you're like, fuck, Liger's, like, going to murder this man. And then, like, out of nowhere, Muta hits the fucking mist on him, the orange mist. And, like Liger goes down, and he hits a beautiful moonsault. Like, like, Muta's moonsaults are second to none. Like, even back in the Sting match, if you watch that, Sting was, like, three quarters away across the ring. We didn't touch on it too much, but crazy. Like, it's a crazy, accurate, beautiful moonsault. Yeah, and he gets the win. And it's like, this came out of nowhere. The second half of the match, I wasn't expecting it. And it was so fucking good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so by the end of the match, the crowd is cheering for Muto. And they're all excited that... who once was a heel is now a face.
This is one of the, I think, all-time great double turns.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a shame that, like, I don't know what happened exactly after this. I don't know what happened in the direct aftermath, but I know that, like, Liger didn't pull out the Kishin Liger persona again for another 10 years. The next time that he, like, unmasked and became the demon was in 2006. So it I don't know how much they really capitalized off of this in the aftermath.
It's cool though, because he doesn't become like the demon Balor where he uses it for every match.
Every fucking time. Yeah. But it's like this moment and this match is like one of my favorite wrestling matches of all time.
Yeah.
Even if just for the spot where like how much more would you believe in Triple H's sledgehammer if they did a spot where, like, he set somebody up on a table and swung the hammer and the guy moved out of the way and he just demolished the hammer, right? It's like that. Yeah. You don't have to actually hurt someone to show intent and to, like, provide those stakes. So the fact that when Liger takes a running leap and just fucking embeds this stake in the table and it's there... sticking out of the table, fucking quivering where a dude's face was 5 seconds beforehand. You feel that,
yeah,
right?
You're like, he was going to fucking murder him.
He was going for it. It wasn't, he didn't cover the tip of the stake and just bop him with it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's amazing. How many bald heads did this get, Josh?
So I can tell you my thought process throughout this match. Like, it was like, you know, through the first part of the match, it was sitting at about a 3.5. You know, that's what I was kind of feeling. Second half just fucking ramped this up. I gave it 4 bald heads just for, like, the second half of this match. Like, it was so good, so intense. I was so invested. And I was like, everything about... And this is 1996, right? This is, like, you know, like 15 years ago or whatever. And it's just, it's crazy to watch and be like, why can't we have, like, cool things like that in matches now that I'm just like, holy fuck, you know, like, just like, that was a real holy fuck moment that I was like, this is so cool.
And again, this is a moment that didn't need, like, it's another match where all of the storytelling took place in the match. Like, I didn't need to know the history of Jushin Liger or Kishin Liger. Like, I don't need to know that to understand what happened there. Like, the turn that happened there.
Yeah.
It's sick.
Yeah. Josh, to answer your question, the reason that we don't get this in modern wrestling is that nobody wears a full body suit with a mask to tear off and reveal that their entire torso and face is painted like a demon.
You could do something cool that's similar to that. I'm sure if I got paid.
Suicide.
Yes. Suicide, yeah. Suicide's the only one.
The closest thing was, make it TJP happen. Under it.
Yeah, yeah.
Not now. They have a new suicide.
Currently, there's another suicide.
What was TJ's peace thing on the last?
Manic.
Yeah. So, but like Manic's mask got torn off, and then it was just like clearly TJP.
Manic was so clearly TJP even while he was Manic. But Suicide is, I think, the gimmick is that no one knows who Suicide is, and it's because he's like fully covered. Like
he can't even has gloves.
You can't see any fucking tattoos. You can't see shit on this man.
Mm-hmm.
So he could reveal his body to be like a demon body if he wanted to.
I think it's Ricochet under there.
No.
totally Ricochet.
He's like a thick man. He's not a young, lean person.
So our next match, we're going 6 years into the future. Every jump is getting a little bit larger. We're exponentially moving into the future. We have a match from All Japan Professional Wrestling in 2002. We have Keiji Muto defending his heavyweight championship title against
Toshiaki Kawada.
Toshiaki, I always fuck up the first name. Toshiaki Kawada. So this is kind of cool. Where like from an outsider perspective, like I looked at this and I was just like, okay, you have one of the big names of '90s New Japan, one of the big names of '90s All Japan, sort of coming together head to head.
Who's what? Sorry.
So Muto worked in like New Japan. Like the last two matches that we watched were New Japan Pro Wrestling, big Muto matches. Kawada came up at the same time as like Misawa and Kenta Kobashi as sort of that like new wave of All Japan Pro Wrestling that like dominated the 1990s in the wake of like Jumbo Tsuruta and Giant Baba in the 80s.
So Kawada is the one who was fighting Misawa in all of those like Meltzer
top-rated
matches?
No, okay. Not all of them, but he was like one of those like three or four dudes that was just in like all of these like greatest matches of the 90s that according to Meltzer.
Right.
So, I was like, for me, I was like, okay, just looking at the list of like good Muto matches to watch, I was like, this seems interesting. The story going into it is that Muto was champ. Kawada had been out for like 14 weeks or something with an injury and was like just coming back.
A leg injury.
So we get a lot of like work in the leg here.
I don't know about you guys. I love The Shining Wizard. I think it's a great move.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but if I never see another fucking Shining Wizard again after this match, that will be too soon.
There were a lot. I also hate that name.
There was so many. I think I counted 12.
I was gonna say I feel like there's probably about 12 or 13. Yeah,
I mean, and it's also a thing where it's like we at this point we have watched 3 Keiji Muto matches and he didn't do a Shining Wizard in any of them.
So now it's his favorite fucking
somewhere movie. In this character reinvention that's become like his signature thing, right?
And it's like I get like even if I see like 5 Rainmakers in a match, I'm still like, which one is gonna finish it? At no point in this match did I ever feel like one of the Shining Wizards was actually gonna end the match. And there were just so many power bombs. And so many Shining Wizards. I really like the storytelling with the leg throughout this match. So, you know, Muto was really going after the leg and doing the snapdragons and all that. The drop kicks, a lot of drop kicks to the leg. Yeah. And I thought they told a good story with the leg. I'll be honest with you. This match was really long. And I wasn't crazy about it. I thought it was a good match. I thought it was solid. I thought it was better than average, but I didn't love it.
I had like, I like agree with you where it isn't like, it's definitely not as exciting as even the Muta versus Sting match that we talked about first. But I will say that this match is at least extremely consistently high intensity and high pace in a way that I I miss from current big, intense New Japan matches. Like, I watch, like, Okada matches that are supposed to be, like, six bald head or six star Meltzer matches.
I know you didn't say six bald heads.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Meltzer will rate some of Okada and Omega's matches as, like, higher than five bald heads. Anyway, you get my point. But, like, they have such, like, they have really high highs, but they have such large valleys. Like, their lows, their dips are so intense, and there's a huge lull where it's really boring. And one thing I don't think that this match is, it's boring. Like, it is high intensity, good, fast-paced action throughout, and I appreciated it for that.
It's, I think this was in our Undertaker episode. There's no moment in this match where, as Connor would put it, commentary says, "These two titans have given it their all!" and you get that lull.
Yeah.
I'm kind of with Josh on this. I do think that this is, like, my least favorite of the five that we watched.
Really?
But I like this match, like, for what you're saying is, like, the intensity, but it's a little repetitive. I think the thing is that, like, when I was watching this, I was trying to put this in context of, like, this is still a good match. This is still an above average match.
Totally.
And for the point in their careers that these two guys are, like, For these two dudes having kind of, like, a lot of their heyday in, like, the early 90s, like, what was Sting doing in 2002? What was Bret Hart doing in 2002? Like, let's compare this to some of their contemporaries and think about, like, I don't think Sting could put on a match at this intensity, take this level of, like, ass whooping at the point of his career that he was at in 2002. This is more of kind of like an impressive feat of the legacy of these two guys. Again, separate competing companies in Japan, like, coming together, having this match. I think it's like an interesting, like, historical thing more so than it is a, like, you gotta watch this.
But, like, I honestly, like, beyond the work on the leg and beyond the, this feels like a very typical Japan paced match where it's like a lot of rest holds in the beginning. There's like a story being told with somebody overcoming something, and this match it happened to be the leg being worked on, right? Then it's like very slow for the first half, and this match is close to 30 minutes long. It's in that ballpark, just to give everybody listening context. So it's very slow to start, and then it's like it ramps up a lot at the end. And again, it's a good match. It's kind of like that traditional kind of format of a match. I really like, there were so many repetitive moves done. Like, again, I'm not exaggerating when I never want to see another fucking Shining Wizard again in a fucking match. 100%. And it was the same with power bombs on the other end, right? Like, it was just like, there were so many, like, weird power bombs too that I was actually worried about, like Muto. Like, I was just like, ooh, it's like, it doesn't look good. But, like, they were, like, giving it their all, and I'm sure there was, like, you know, the value and the crowd was invested and all this. But, like, me watching it, by the end of it, I was just like, let's just kind of wrap this up. I feel like great concept. It looks like the match was booked well. I would say the execution was maybe, like, a 5 out of 10. Like, it was just like, if they would have, like, spiced it up with some different stuff or not kept going back to the well on certain things, I would have liked it more, but I don't know.
How many bald heads? How many freshly shorn KG Muto bald heads?
I gave it 3.5. Would you give this? I gave it 3.5.
3.5? Yeah.
That's good.
And that's, I think the last thing on this match that I think is really interesting is that, like, again, when we talked about our Undertaker episode, or when we did our Undertaker episode, when we talked about the Undertaker, that idea of, like, there came a point in his career where he couldn't transition out of being the Undertaker he always had to do, like, there's a threshold, right? Where it's like, you've been the Undertaker this long, now you just have to be the Undertaker forever. And you're old and you can't wrestle anymore, but you still have to pretend to be the Undertaker, and you still have to do the fucking, like, old school, and you still have to do all of these moves that you can't really do anymore because they're tied to this character, and you have to wear a fucking cowboy hat to the ring. And I do think that it's interesting that if you look at Muto, like, this is a point where he's not doing the Great Muta gimmick anymore. He's not spitting green mist. He's not painting his face.
He's a beautiful bald boy.
He's just, like, bald and has a goatee, and he looks fucking jacked.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, or, like, if you take, like, a Sting comparison, that, like, how we're saying now that, like, Sting coming out in AEW doing the makeup that he was doing in 1996 versus Muto wrestling in Noah, and he's not wearing the makeup that he wore in 1996, and was, like, you think maybe around this time, around this, like, early 2000s is, like, the time period in which these guys all had the choice to make, and that, like, Undertaker and Sting maybe made the wrong choice, and Muta was somewhat able to, like, age gracefully as a wrestler, where he doesn't have to fucking, like, can you imagine this match if he had his fucking face painted gold and tried to green mist Kawada at some point? It would have felt so forced and just, like, not the story of this match, or, like, the next match that we're getting into, if he had, like, had his face painted and came out all, like, spooky. That would have been fucking brutal to watch. And I respect the dude for, like, giving it up and just being like, yeah, you know what? I did that, and now I'm just going to be me. I've earned it. I have a legacy. I'm just a fucking guy that's going to kick your ass now.
It's also just more interesting to have a character evolve,
right? I agree, but also it's like, you have to be diverse in your character, right? Like, you have to have, like, more things that you go to in a match. Like, there were so many figure fours, there were so many leg locks, there were so many, like, things, like, that really focused on the leg that I really liked, but it really, they were placed weirdly in the match that it really, like, it was, like, a lot of stop gaps in the match, right? And then it was like, and again, everything he did other than that was a shiny wizard, and I'm not even shitting.
Yeah.
And so it's like, if you want to change it up a little bit, go to the outside, get, like, a little rough and tumble for a little bit. Like, whatever it is, like, just, like, the match itself could have been better. Like, it could have been, like, one of those four-star matches and, like, a graceful evolved into, like your new character. But, like, it felt lazy at times, if I can say that.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. That's interesting. I definitely enjoyed this match more than you two did. But
three and a half bald heads, pretty good score. But
Yeah. I would give it about that, too. So
no, that's I think what that's Rosemary's Wedding on the bald head scale.
About that.
Did we say that Kawada wins this one?
Kawada does win this match, which is a big moment, coming back from the injury, taking the title for like getting the title, a dude who has been with the company, you know.
So we are next, our final match.
Our fifth match over four promotions and 30 fucking 2 years.
And, like, this is, like, from the last match we covered, like, with Kawada, 2002. This is 2021, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a 19-year jump.
19-year jump.
Yeah. It's a big jump. His hair goes from speckled silver to full white.
Yeah.
And by hair, I mean his beard hair chest hair.
And his chest hair. He's got wiry white chest hair now.
Yeah.
So this happened February 12th. Go Shiozaki coming in as the GHC heavyweight champion against Keiji Muto. Shiozaki had, I still haven't gotten around to watching it, but apparently that the title defense that he had in November was, like, insane, one of the top five matches of last year. So I still might go back and watch that. They say that he's been champ for 1 year, he's had six title defenses, which is something that, like, I really like that idea of. I feel like AEW's been kind of booking that way.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, it makes the title feel a little bit more important when, like, you can think about, like, oh, Moxley was champ for almost a year and he only defended against, like, three people.
Sure.
You know, as, like, opposed to, like,
they should start, like, tracking title defenses in AEW. Like, that should be at the ticker at the bottom, right? Like, for both the TNT and the AEW championship. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. As opposed to, like, Roman Reigns. How many times has Roman Reigns defended the Universal title since he's been champion from August, right? Like, probably about as many times as Shiozaki defended the title in a year.
Yeah. Yeah, like, honestly, because he defends it every pay-per-view, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
Every pay-per-view. And, like, fucking four of them have been against the same guy. So, like, at a certain point, you know, you kind of stop giving a shit. But, yeah, any like, this match, getting into it.
Man,
Muto comes out in a sick, like, white tasseled long coat. And he's got his ripping guitar solo still. And he's got his white goatee, close cut white goatee, and white chest hair, bald head, looking really good for 58. To be honest, like,
straight up,
looking fucking sick.
He looks the same as he did the last match that we watched. Like, I was looking, I was like, besides like the graying of the hair, he still looks fucking jacked as shit. You can tell his knees are bother him a little bit, but like. Man.
I feel like he's got a little bit more tummy, but like so much less than, say, Jericho. Not to body shame Jericho, but like he's a little bit more tummy because he's an older man. Yeah. But like he is in shape.
If the Muda scale is like how much blood you lose in one match, is the Jericho scale how much of a boiler you build in 1 year?
Oh.
Yeah, there's one thing I want to get right off the bat in this match. Muda says fuck so many times, and I love it. Every time
I also had that written down.
Every time Muda gets chopped in this match, every time he gets hit in this match, Muda's breathing heavy. He's like, oh, oh, oh. And then, like, he's like, every time he gets a chop, he's like, fuck. And then, like, there's one point that he's so exhausted in the match that he throws a Shining Wizard, of course, but he says, you motherfucker! And then he throws Shining Wizard. I love how much he says fuck. And like, I was watching a previous match. I think it was maybe, I forget which one, maybe the Liger match. But I was like, did you just say fuck in that match? And in this match, all doubts were confirmed. That man screams fuck all the time, and I love it.
Yeah.
That's sick.
So, Go Shiozaki is like, he looks like Great Value Okada, right?
Yeah. Like, so much like Okada.
Which is like not, I don't think necessarily to discredit him. It's like, it's a look that works. I think he seems like a good champ. Like, he comes across as like a very good wrestler. This is the first match I've ever watched from that dude. I really like him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I also think it's like interesting that all of the Japanese promotions have like these like really grandiose fake title names. Like, it's not just like, it's the GHC Heavyweight Championship. It's not just the Pro Wrestling Noah Heavyweight Championship. Yeah. Or like in New Japan, it's not the New Japan Pro Wrestling Heavyweight Championship. It's the IWGP Heavyweight Championship. Like, they have fictional governing bodies that have created these championships.
Oh, I see.
That I think is really, really interesting. And I, like, to me as a viewer, like, honestly does give the title a little bit more prestige, you know?
And I also like the look of the Noah belts too, right? The Noah belts look kind of similar to the New Japan belts, but I like the aesthetic of them. They're really nice.
Yeah.
They look good.
It's kind of like watching, when we were watching like the WCW match, and it was like, it was for the NWA television championship.
Yeah.
Is a thing where it's like, okay, cool. Like that lends some credence that like this belt means something beyond just the promotion that it's in.
Yeah.
Whereas like when, if you have like the AEW heavyweight championship or the Impact Wrestling heavyweight championship, it's like, okay, cool. The language of that says like you are the champion of this company, whereas like having your, even though it's functionally the same, having your belt named after something that isn't just the company that you're in makes it seem more important to me.
It was cool when NWA was trying to do that, right? Like, they were trying to have Nick Aldis be the like NWA champion and like defend it in different territories and go to All Out and, or sorry, All In and defend it and like all this stuff. Like I thought that was a really cool concept. And I think it would work now with like AEW, Impact, New Japan, all kind of opening their doors a little bit and everybody just kind of like doing whatever they do. I think having Nick Aldis kind of as a touring champion would work now better than it worked before. And I would love to see that now.
Yeah. Okay, so we talked about appearances. We talked about what I like about the belt. We talked about Muto saying fuck a lot. We can get into the match now.
So this match starts out very slow. There's lots of holds in the beginning and just like everyone taking their sweet time. And I was kind of like, oh no, Muto can't go as hard as he used to. So that's why they're taking it really slow. And this is going to be like a holds match and like a submission match, which I was not into at all. But I will say like the pace sort of picks up a bit. There are like bigger moves that happen, mainly like striking moves. But I mean, of the matches that we've covered today, this one's the least intense and exciting, but it picks up. I don't know. It's like Muta shows that he can still go for sure in this match, but he definitely isn't what he used to be.
Yeah, there's a spot in the match where Muta goes for the, he's climbing to the top rope to hit the moonsault. And he can't do it in the match, which was kind of a bummer. I was watching that. I was like, oh, that's sad.
He also, there's like one like spinning kick that he throws that looked like CM Punk trying to throw a kick in the UFC, where he just like kind of falls on his ass.
Yeah.
I think the thing to me that's interesting about this match is that like the real life story of the match is like way more interesting than the story that was presented.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that I think it was a little bit that was lost in translation. I thought the commentary really kind of undersold this match. Cause there were moments where it was like, you have your young up and coming, like fighting champion at the peak of his career versus the old grizzled veteran challenging for this championship for the first time because it'll complete sort of like his legacy, I think is an amazing story. And I think that like in the physical storytelling of the wrestling match, you get bits of that. You get moments where Muta tries to pick up Shiozaki for like a power slam and he can't quite get him up and falls over and he has to take another shot at it. You have, I think they could, if commentary had done a better job selling Muta going to the top rope for the moonsault and not being able to do it, that would have been a great moment as opposed to kind of reading as a botch. There's a lot in this match that I actually really, really liked solely by creating my own narrative and completely ignoring the commentary.
Yeah.
That I do think if you had had like a Kevin Kelly on commentary and you had been able to have this match with a more vocal crowd, I think this match would have been a lot better than it actually was, because so much of wrestling is how it's packaged and how it's like how it's broadcast.
And let me just say we're holding Muta to a certain standard, but like he's 58, you know, and if I can get out of bed at 58, I'd be impressed. And so for him to have, how long was this match? 30, 35 minutes? You know, even with the wrestles, like even with everything else, they told a decent story in the ring. And I think Campbell nailed a lot of points as far as like, you know, like this is like Muto's time to like really complete this, you know, trifecta and like, you know, the young hungry champ who's defended it more than anybody else, and his body's a little bit worn out because of all the defenses he's had. You know, I thought they told a pretty decent story in the ring, and honestly, it's like, I thought it was a pretty decent match, all in all. Like, it was a little draggy in some places, but I thought Muta looked as better than any 58-year-old in the ring now, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Like, he can definitely still go, and he has a lot of intensity. And I think his intensity is what sold it. Even if he wasn't able to, like, serve the moves that he used to do, his intensity went a long way for, like, selling what he was doing. He wins. I describe this as a head scissors suplex. I can't remember what it is where you grab the dude's head with your ankles and flip him.
A Hurricane Rana.
A Hurricane Rana.
A Frankensteiner.
Okay, I wrote Hank Frankensteiner, but I don't, in my mind, that's not what a Frankensteiner is. Anyway, so he does that. And one of the things I really liked is he pins him by holding his Shiazaki's throat down. Like, he holds him by the throat, and that's the pin.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Very, like, dominant and just, like, fuck you, boy. I liked it.
It's. I think the biggest thing for me is that this match didn't, like, it still felt, Muto still felt convincing. Muto still felt like this was, like, an earned victory. This didn't feel like Goldberg, despite the fact that they're both bald, jacked guys with gray goatees. Like, this wasn't a...
Goldberg would literally pass away if he was at a match this long. There's no fucking way. So it's just 100% earned.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like, Muto can't go like he used to, but he's still dangerous.
And it's, the storytelling in the ring that the fucking dog shit commentary team missed out on is, like, moments where... Like, Muto at one point, like, they're kind of grappling, and he, like, shifts his hip and moves his leg in a way that he's able to do, like, a judo throw.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a thing where it's like, this is, it's not, like I said before, it's not the Undertaker still trying to do an old school when he's too old to balance on the ropes, or trying to get somebody up for a tombstone when he can't lift somebody as heavy as Roman Reigns. It's like, this is the old grizzled veteran using his experience and his know-how and changing his style to wrestle in a way that suits him as an older guy. It's a really, really fucking...
Use the youngin's strength against him.
It's such a good match, like, except for the fact that it wasn't that good of a match, like, if that makes sense.
Like, you could have sold it if you had been able to sell it. You could have sold it better.
And that's the thing is, like, I really think that this comes down to if you had had somebody like a Kevin Kelly on commentary, if you had had somebody like an Excalibur or a
Matt Stryker,
somebody on commentary who was able to pick up the nuances of the in-ring storytelling that would have elevated this. Because it's like, sometimes you have a match that's so good that the in-ring storytelling completely sells itself, language barriers, anything aside, like the Liger match or like the Vader match. Sometimes you have a match that's like a good story told in ring that needs the commentary to elevate it to a great story in ring.
Mm.
And I think this is one of those matches that is like a good match that with better production in a better promotion could have been a great match.
Yeah.
I agree.
How many bald heads do you give this, buddy?
I gave this 3.5. I thought this about on par with the last match I saw. Like, it was a good match, some good storytelling in the match. It was better than average. And I think, you know, Muta gets a couple more shiner points because he's a 58-year-old man going in there and doing that. And he's, like, still the toughest uncle at a barbecue, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Shiazaki won't shake hands with him after he shakes his finger at him saying, no, 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 we're not done.
I'm coming back for that.
Yeah.
It's great. It's I think it's it's like in how much it is not a Goldberg match. It doesn't, Shiazaki doesn't look bad for losing this. And it does is like, sets up a redemption arc for the guy that you've chosen to really carry your company for a while.
Yeah, I think that's really important. He didn't look bad in losing. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he got caught and, you know, he's worn down. Like, he's defended a lot. This narrative of the story is like his shoulders were both taped up. His legs were bad.
Yeah, he had lots of tape.
Like, you know, like, so it's, I think they told a good story as far as that goes.
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. I think it would be cool if they had a rematch and the stipulation was title versus career.
That's a great idea.
You know?
Yeah.
Give them the book.
And, like, have that be Muto's retirement, because he doesn't need to be champion for that long.
You know, he just needed the championship, right? Like he just
needed the belt to complete the legacy. And I think, like, if Shiozaki goes down in history as the guy who fucking retired Muto, it more than makes up for
it, elevates him dropping, right? That belt, like, and like, you know, him getting caught on a quick roll up, you know, mm-hmm. and then him regaining it, giving his body time to like recover. Like, I think, yeah. I think the next setup they're going to do is that guy who came to the ring and stared Muta down. Have a quick match with those two.
Again, who commentary refused to tell me his name.
Or I had no idea
what the story
or
was.
Or why he was there.
Literally, this is what they said. They go, this guy's in the ring. He's staring down Muto. His stare is enough to tell the whole story. And I was just like, what's the story? Yeah,
no, your job is that's to your tell job. The whole story. It's yeah. You know, it's yes. You guys.
I'm assuming that guy was so handsome. My assumption was that he was a member of BTS. I don't know why.
Okay. He's Muto's son.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know who this is.
And I just want to say everybody on this podcast totally respects BTS. We're not knocking them at all. It's really important that everybody in the BTS community knows that we really like BTS.
Mm-hmm.
Don't cancel us.
So that kind of sums up our 5-match career retrospective of the great Muta, as if an illustrious career like that could be summed up in 5 matches, but we did what we could.
Mm-hmm.
We like to close out every episode here with a little a high spot and a botched spot, a little honorable mention to something that we liked, something that we didn't really like so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll start off because my two are obvious. My high spot is the Vader match. That was
okay.
One of the best matches I've ever seen in my life. And especially during that match, like, it just, like, Vader in that match, like Muta was such a good white meat babyface in that match. It was great. But Vader in that match really took care of him so well. With the way he was throwing, mm-hmm. It was a little stiff, but he caught him every time. He was really like guiding that match, and he was such a good big man. And a lot of people forget because of his weird WWE run afterwards, where he had like kind of so-so matches. But seeing Vader mm-hmm. in like this light, I have never seen this match before today, but that was for sure the high spot. Low spot, say the amount of shiny wizards I saw during that one match. Sucks.
I had a feeling.
Yeah. I thought your high spot was going to be how much Muto said "fuck" in that.
It was close. It was a close one, but the Vader match had to be the high spot.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else can take the fuck stuff.
Well, since you brought up Vader already, I was thinking about having his entrance be my high spot. But since you've got Vader already, I'm going to choose Kishin Liger. And specifically, I'm going to focus on the crowd flipping as opposed to like the Kishin and the Muto in that match. I'm going to focus on the fact that the crowd did a 180 on their chosen babyface or their chosen guy that they wanted to win
mm-hmm.
in that match was beautifully executed. It was so perfectly encapsulated. Like, again, it might be because I'm so starved for like hearing the crowd, but like, hearing the crowd respond to this swerve is amazing. Like, they sold it so well. Like, they were so behind Liger. And then when he becomes Kishin, they're so confused and quiet for a while. And then they respond so positively and intensely when Muto ducks the stake to the face. It really sold the moment and sold, like, how big this moment was of Kishin coming out and Kishin turning.
It was very cool. It was very cool.
Yeah. That's my high spot. My botch spot is, I guess, just the final most recent match between Muto and Shiozaki. I thought it was like a little lackluster, and maybe it's because of the commentary, like you were saying, Campbell, or maybe it was like the pacing of it. I feel like maybe because the match didn't have enough storytelling for me, or like the commentary didn't do enough storytelling, I was wondering if a video package would have really helped me with this match.
I mean, they had a video package, but it was just in Japanese.
Yeah.
Like, all I saw from that video package is that he was 58.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just thought it was like, I'm glad that he got this accolade and it like this final championship to like round out his like nice little shiny wall of championships, but it was a little disappointing, I guess. But I also wouldn't want him to not have it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My botch spot was like definitely the commentary team for that match, like specifically because I think that's a thing where it's like I said, that match would have been better if it had a better commentary team, and they really dropped the ball in telling the story that they needed to tell, or do their part in telling the story that they needed to tell. They kept referring to the GHC Heavyweight Championship as the most coveted belt in all of professional wrestling, which is
shots fired.
Like, you can't say that. That's not true.
It's a thing where it's like, I understand the mentality of trying to treat your promotion as if it's the best, but I also think it's a thing where, like, something that would have really helped that match is if they acknowledged the fact that they were like, hey, you know, if you're, like, Keiji Muto is a big fucking name and he's 58 years old, and if you're a first-time viewer and you're coming in just for him, well, like, here's what you've been missing out on, and here's the story.
Here's the history of the belt. Like people like this have held the title. Like, you don't say something ridiculous like, this is the most important belt. Because everybody knows, if you're watching wrestling, you know about WWE, like, and you know about New Japan.
Yeah, it's like, that's not even the most coveted belt in your country.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
it's true.
And it's a thing where it's like, if you as a commentator do your fucking job to tell the story that needs to be told for this match.
The lineage. To tell the lineage.
Then maybe it will become the most coveted belt in wrestling. If you mm-hmm. do your job to elevate this and like, because like, I think Noah, from what I've seen, is a good company with a good history.
Sure.
And that, like, you know, New Japan is in kind of a spot right now where if Noah has kind of a push, like, they could potentially, I feel like Noah could potentially be the AEW in Japan to sure. NJPW's WWE. Sure. And if you're, like, you need a commentary team to, like, tell those stories and give you those moments as a viewer to elevate that.
Yeah.
Or just, like, a really banger promotion, a really banger promo by mm-hmm. a really skilled wrestler like Jake Atlas promoing his championship title at Aldis.
Oh, Nick Aldis.
I was like, Jake Atlas. What titles does he
Sorry, have? I could tell by your face. Let me take it again. Or you just need someone who's a really solid promo, like
Jake Atlas.
Nick Aldis.
Yeah.
So you're saying Nick Aldis is a better, is his title's more prestigious than the most prestigious title in the world, the Noah Heavyweight Championship.
The way he presents it, yes. Yeah. Like, he fucking sells the shit you. Out of that title.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you said, Josh, he sells the lineage of the title.
Right?
More than anything.
That's the most important thing. It's like, tell me who's held this before. Tell me why it's important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell me who you've beat.
My high spot is definitely the Kishin Liger match.
Yeah.
And it's, what's interesting, I think, is that, like, watching that previously is, like, all I really noticed about it was Liger. And rewatching it now in the context of watching a bunch of Muta matches and realizing that, like, Liger couldn't have had that moment with any other opponent. And watching that as kind of like the pinnacle and the peak of the great Muta character and shtick, and his performance of that character is so good. And that's a match where, like, every little piece is exactly what it needed to be, and it is greater than the sum of its parts. It's absolutely perfect. I fucking love that match.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's it, I guess. If you have any thoughts on the career of the great Muta, if there's matches that we missed out on, like, I don't think we're going to do another episode, but like, I want to watch them. So yeah. Check those out and let us know at facebook.com/stonecoldshots. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at Stone Cold Shots and Stone Cold Shots Pod and Stone Cold Shots Podcast.
You can leave us a rating and a review on your podcasting app of choice.
Give us those 5 bald heads every day, all day, every day.
Heck yeah.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.